I'd like now to welcome Charles Falco. He is Chair of Condensed Matter Physics and Professor of Optical Sciences at the University of Arizona. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Now, you and the great artist David Hockney have developed the Hockney-Falco thesis, namely that in certain paintings made as early as 1430, these paintings were produced as a result of the artist using either concave mirrors or refractive lenses to project images of objects illuminated by sunlight onto the canvas, onto the artist's canvas. First of all, and this is a very interesting thesis, before we talk about this, the art, something I never really thought to ask, but when were the mirror and the lens invented in the first place, and how were they used?
Well, in both cases, they predated our the paintings that we're talking about by anywhere from hundreds to thousands of years. Now, specifically, reading spectacles were invented in the around 1350, so 100 years before we're saying that someone like Jan van Eyck used them. Concave mirrors were used as far back as antiquity, around the year zero. Archimedes is said to have used a burning mirror, a concave mirror, to burn the fleet that was trying to sack Syracuse at the time, or a few hundred B.C. But certainly the technology for making the appropriate concave mirrors is described in great detail, such that you could follow it exactly today, 100 years before Van Eyck.
So let's go to the works of art that tipped you off. I mean, what were the specific works of art that got you thinking about the relationship between the art and optics?
Well, this first started out as a visual discovery by David Hockney. He's an excellent artist. He knows his skill level. There were certain paintings, for example, Jan van Eyck's Arnolfini Marriage, around 1425, I can't remember the exact date, that's on at the National Gallery in London. And David did his student art training at the Royal Academy in London. So he's been looking at that painting for his entire career and seeing certain features in it that it wasn't like he thought van Eyck could have done it better than he did. It was the skill level was just beyond anything he could conceive of any artist that he knew of. And so this has been puzzling him for many years, many decades. And then once I got involved with David, we extracted actually quantitative optical evidence from that painting that shows that Van Eyck used optics to project the chandelier that's in that painting, for example.
How is it that this was not known before?
Interesting question. It certainly was not known before. All the paintings that we examined are from major museums, the Louvre, the Prado, the National Gallery in Washington, and so on. And if you look up their attendance figures, you'll see that 25 million people a year attend those museums. And that's, roughly speaking, 25 million different people will attend next year. So it's not like a lot of people haven't looked at these paintings. But apparently no one ever asked the question. There wasn't the right combination of person who understood the art and understood the optics that could ask both questions. Could an artist have done this? And did the optics exist at the time to have served as an aid? And for whatever reason, no one ever asked the question before. And so, I mean, that's the nature of a discovery when you're the first to do it.
It's interesting, too, because I guess it takes an artist, and a lot of, I would say, probably most art historians are not themselves artists, to look at something and say, how could anybody have done this?
Exactly. Most art historians are not trained in art. They're not trained in science. They examine some other area other than the kinds of issues that we addressed, although this does step into the territory that they claim as their own. If you are not a skilled artist, for example, I'm not a skilled artist. If I look at a drawing, all I know is that the person who drew that certainly is much more skilled than I am. A David Hockney will look at a drawing, in particular by an Ingres, which really got him started on this, and thought, this is extremely realistic, but the drawing itself is not a natural size. It was too small. Now, that doesn't mean an artist couldn't draw something small, but as a David Hockney looking at this, that's a clue that the fact that it's so small, he questions, why would an artist have done this? And in that particular case, it turns out that the artist used a camera lucida to do the drawing, which forced it to be smaller than you would do naturally if you were just using the unaided eye.
So tell us more about the effects that are achieved by using optics in these paintings that couldn't be done just by looking at it with the naked eye. Well, you just gave one example of that. But for example, in some of the Renaissance painting, what could they achieve doing it that way?
Okay, so I need to clarify a point. We're not saying that none of these features could not have been done without optics, that a modern artist today conceivably could reproduce the features that we found. So we're not saying that. What we're saying, in fact, is that an artist like Van Eyck may have had the skill not to have used optics, but were able to extract optical evidence, in some cases, a variety of features within the same painting that all agree with the laws of geometrical optics to an accuracy of 0.5%, that would not have been done with the unaided eye. It's statistically impossible to have been done without the use of optics. So where optics would be an aid, in that Arnolfini marriage, I think many of your listeners can picture this, so I'll talk about that one for a second. There's a husband and a wife, and there's a small dog that's on the floor in front of them, and there's a complicated chandelier over their head and a convex mirror behind them. Where optics would be useful would be for that chandelier. It's sitting there. The husband and wife don't have to be in place. You can project it. You can work with that for as long as you need be, and it's very complicated, and we've shown the evidence that it was used. The little dog, optics is useless. The dog is running around. Anybody who's ever seen a little dog knows it's running around yapping and everything. Optics doesn't help you because it doesn't stand still. The fact that Van Eyck could paint that little dog so accurately that we can recognize its breed today, 600 years later, tells you he didn't need to use optics, if you want to use that language. But the fact that we've got this evidence in the chandelier shows that he did use optics. So it's important to keep those two points separate. They're logically separate. So sometimes modern artists will get a few types of very artists who have actually constructed an entire business model based on them producing your portrait exactly like the old masters did without optics. They're naturally upset that we're saying that optics was used by the old masters. But keep those two points separate. Where optics would be useful also, if you were a very rich woman in the court and you had a complicated dress with very complicated pattern in it, and you're sitting with, there's folds and there's creases and all sorts of things in there, to take that three-dimensional complicated pattern and put it in two dimensions on painting is a very difficult thing for an artist to do. If you project it, it just makes your life so much easier. So the artist could have the lady-in-waiting deliver the dress all by itself. He could keep it for as long as he needed and then add the owner's head and arms to it and create a portrait. And he could do that from real life without projecting the image.
Now, a question that probably has come up for other people besides me in looking at this is the question, hey, if they were using projections onto their canvas, were they somehow cheating?
Yeah, that comes up a lot, but it turns out artists usually don't ask that question. People who don't have artistic skill do ask that question. These projections are at very high magnification, approximately 1:1. In everyday life, we're used to taking a camera, and you can take your digital camera, shoot a photo of your friends, and you take a scene that's 6 feet tall, your friends, and you reduce it to the imaging device that's in your camera that's, let's just say, 1 inch tall, 0.5 inch tall. That's a very small magnification. It's a magnification of maybe 0.01. So the portraits, though, you've seen in museums are nearly life-size. They're half life-size. They're very large. The optical effects of depth of field and of brightness get to be more severe the larger the magnification. So, in fact, it's very difficult to project an image at half life-size and make use of it. And one of the things that I'm fond of saying is that if you thought someone like Van Eyck was a genius, you actually underestimated him, that he was much more clever than you give him credit for. He wasn't cheating by using a lens. He was pushing forward the science of imaging considerably.
Now, I take it you've reproduced these techniques.
Yes, every one of them that we've shown, we've reproduced. In fact,
and
if you go to my webpage, you can see videos of a few of the things that we've reproduced.
Right. It's a very interesting process. For example, the painting you were just talking about, the Arnolfini marriage, that has a convex mirror in the background. What is that all about? Is that the mirror or the kind of mirror that was used as the optical device in that particular painting?
Well, no, but with that mirror, at the time when people had developed the technology to make convex mirrors, like a security mirror, what it does something very handy for you, is it takes a larger area of the world than you can naturally see, and it puts it right in front of you. That Gutenberg, before he produced his Bible, one of the things that he did is there was every 10 years a pilgrimage to the cathedral in Aachen, Germany, and he sold small hand-sized convex mirrors so people could go into the cathedral and you could see like large areas of the ceiling and the sides of the wall simultaneously by looking at the reflection in the convex mirror. So people were interested in the optical qualities of the time. What we're talking about are concave mirrors, the backside of it, and that one's too sharply curved to produce a image large enough for us. In fact, the degree of concavity that you need is very little. It almost looks flat. So if you go to the drugstore today and you buy a shaving mirror, a makeup mirror, that often they're double-sided. One side is flat, one side is slightly curved to magnify. Well, if you just kind of grab it, typically you can't even tell which is the curved side. You kind of have to look at it for a second or flip from one side to the other to double-check to make sure which side is up to see the magnifying side. That's because it's so gently curved that it looks almost flat. That's the degree of curvature that's on the mirrors that we found people like Van Eyck used.
We're talking to Charles Falco, and he will be at the James A. Little Theater tonight giving a lecture called Art, Optics, and Human Vision. That's at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater. Now, do the mirrors and lenses that appear in paintings like this one also have a symbolic or metaphorical meaning?
Well, no, you're stepping outside my field of expertise. That, of course, they've had symbolic meanings and metaphorical meanings, but there's lots of discussion amongst people who, you know, someone will say the dog in this painting is placed there because it represents fidelity. Well, okay, fair enough. If somebody else may have some other explanation for why the dog is in the painting, you know, None of those explanations actually are susceptible to scientific test. And I'm a scientist. The kinds of postulates that we're making about the mirrors are subject to scientific tests. If this mirror were used to project an image, it should have the following artifacts, consequences of it, and we check those consequences. And so that's how we proceed by to show that optics were used. And I should say, not to criticize radio, but I really do encourage people to come tonight because I will show any number of examples. We're talking about a visual story here, and I can say all the words I want about a concave mirror in a painting. If you see it, you go, aha, that's what he meant.
So right,
come
right.
And I'll show you.
Yeah, if I could hold the pictures up to the microphone and I would.
Well, I've been holding them up to the telephone here, but you haven't been responding.
Well, what do we know about the relationship between artists and scientists during the Renaissance?
Well, we use the term Renaissance man to describe people at the time. And it turns out Jan van Eyck was incorrectly credited for years for having invented oil paint. It was later discovered he didn't invent it. No one was really upset with the idea, but that would make him a chemist. If you invent oil paint, mixing the pigments in the linseed oil and being able to put this on a canvas makes him a chemist. He was a Renaissance man. He was combining arts and science. I'm adding to this mix that he was also an optical scientist in this. So we know that these people at the time Leonardo da Vinci is creating incredible paintings, but he's also making machines of war, drawings of machines of war, drawings of helicopters, drawings of parachutes. So there was not the strict job description regimentation that we seem to find today.
It's interesting that in looking for historical documentation about the use of lenses and mirrors, you actually found a lot of that in literature, like Chaucer, as well as other kinds of treatises.
And that's another thing that is fascinating to me, the strict compartmentalization of disciplines. So has led people, when reading a Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, you come across a description of Alizane and perspective and mirrors. Well, what does that mean, and who knows, and we go on. No one discusses this. Well, it turns out, now that I've discovered, I've published a couple of papers on this so far, Alizane was Ibn al-Haytham, who was a 11th century Arab scientist who, in fact, is responsible for our modern theory of vision. That he was a pre-Renaissance man. We give Kepler credit for having invented the theory of the retinal image, that our lens in our eyeball focuses the images upside down, flip left or right on our back of our eyeball. His article, let's say, manuscript that postulated that was titled Amendments to Vitello. Vitello was a Roman Catholic priest who is also called Alizane's ape for having just plagiarized Ibn al-Haytham's work. So our modern theory of retinal vision, in fact, is a minor variation of Ibn al-Haytham. And it's funny that I, as a optical scientist, discover these things through my collaboration with a world-class painter, because I'm looking for documentation. And other people should have discovered this years before, seen this connection much before, if the disciplines weren't so narrowly defined.
Well, I think that's a very important lesson of the work that you're doing, is the extreme importance of interdisciplinary work and conversation, talking with people in totally different fields. How do you think artists and scientists and other academics can be encouraged to do this kind of cross-disciplinary collaboration?
Well, I claim that actually artists and scientists have the same job description. Our job is to look at some aspect of the world that doesn't quite make sense to us, figure it out, and then explain it. And an artist does the same thing. Artists may be trying to convey, say, the sadness of war or the futility of war or the ill-definable aspects of love. They're trying to examine the world and convey it visually to people. And scientists do the same thing. So I found that artists almost universally, with one categorical exception, have been very receptive to what Hockney and I have proposed. And the one exception is these people I talked to before, who have set themselves up to produce very realistic paintings without optics, just like the old masters did. And so naturally they're kind of upset by this.
Well, your work does bring up interesting questions about what realism is, because what is projected onto a canvas using optics and what is seen with the naked eye, you know, with, you know, two-point perspective, one-point perspective, and so on, maybe aren't palpably different, or maybe are visibly different, but they're different. And, you know, so what is real? What is realism in painting? I mean, these are issues that you bring up.
And these are actually extremely important issues. That we, at the invention of photography in 1839, some painters thought, well, this is the end of our career, because before, you would have sent me as a painter off to Spain to paint the Princess of Spain, to give it to the Prince of England to see if he wanted to marry her. Like, she's not very good looking. If you throw in an extra duchy, okay, I'll take her. And so it's up to the painter to convey the reality of the situation. Now we have photography. But now it turns out with Photoshop, we've just seen this now in the news just a few days ago, did the Iranians fire 3 missiles or did they fire 4 missiles? And you see another missile Photoshopped in. And there are many other examples of this where the photography doesn't provide us with a real situation. Even if you take the raw, unaltered image, you certainly can position yourself with a camera to hide things, hide some defects that you don't want to have shown, is that reality or not? It comes now to, I would say, an ethical artist creating a scene could create a scene that might convey the reality of that scene better than any 20-megapixel digital camera, because they put in what really is there, and they leave out things that are extraneous to, that would distract you.
You've said that there's a one category of artists that has been not very friendly to your thesis. What about art historians? Have art historians embraced this whole thesis of yours and David Hockney's and run with it?
I'd say largely not. Largely, art historians have been very unreceptive to it. I could imagine various reasons for this. One is that, you know, I've shown, for example, in a certain painting that 6 equations and 7 unknowns, we calculate features to 0.5% accuracy and show that optics were used. Well, an art historian is not even trained in that language. So how do they deal with something like that? The other is that art and art history are different disciplines. And so here you have an artist, not an art historian, and a scientist, not an art historian, who have come in and said, okay, take this Jan van Eyck, Arnold Fini marriage, one of the most iconic images of Western art of 600 years that any number of doctoral dissertations have been written on, and we haven't done infrared reflectography, we haven't done nuclear magnetic resonance, we've done nothing that you couldn't have done. We've only looked at the image itself, and we've seen something that you've missed. And it's not something minor that you've missed. You missed the fact that they were using optics 200 years earlier than anyone even thought possible. Well, if you're an art historian and you're sort of an expert on Van Eyck, you won't take that as a friendly observation, I would
say. So there's a territorial, sort of academic territorial thing going on.
That's been my observation of this. And I can understand why this is the case, that people from completely outside their discipline have come in and said, you've missed something that you should have seen. We don't phrase it quite like that, but that really is the case.
Now, how has this discovery or set of discoveries affected David Hockney's own work as an artist, if it has?
Well, it certainly has affected his own artwork. I've got several paintings I use as examples that he made shortly after we started working together, where he was incorporating aspects of projected images into, he wasn't actually projecting the images, but he was incorporating what he learned from projecting images into his paintings, and it had a fairly strong effect. He made several portraits of me that I can guarantee you he didn't use optics directly to create the portraits. But now, having already said that we've got to show the images to understand what we're talking about, I'm going to make the conversation even more complicated. Everything we've been talking about is about the direct use of optics. I project an image and I trace part of it. There's also the indirect use of optics, which is extremely strong. If you had never seen a projected image, and I project an image for you, I take your complicated three-dimensional world with a huge range of brightnesses and tonal values, and I compress it into 2 dimensions onto a canvas in front of you, and you see that, and you're a painter, that, I argue, would fundamentally affect how you create paintings in the future. And so that's the indirect use of optics, even when you don't project images, that you make use indirectly of this, the way these images look. And so it ends up being fairly complicated. Well, David has indirectly used optics, since he's projected many images and we've done many experiments with this, and it's entered into what he's done. He's now painting the largest landscapes he's ever painted. They're just gigantic. He donated one of these to the Tate. It was just in the news a month or two ago. 15 feet tall. I can't even remember how tall they are, and 30 feet wide, where he's trying to, as he would say, the camera gives you the surface of a scene. He's figuring out ways to bring the viewer into the scene. And this is influenced, highly influenced, by the work we've done on optics.
We're talking to Charles Falco. How does this work fit in with the other work you do as a scientist? Is it a sideline, or does it fit into your other scientific work?
Well, it started out as a total sideline, and now it's become central to an area I work on in computerized image analysis. That people have worked on trying to have a computer analyze an image for 50 years, ever since the computers were invented, and have made very, very little progress. Our computers now are just orders of magnitude more powerful than they were even 20 years ago. Yet, if I took a photograph of you, scanned it into the computer, and then asked the computer, not even to tell me who you are, just, is this a dog? Is it a cat? Is it a woman? Computers don't do that, in spite of all this work that's gone into that. Well, I would argue that the people who've been working on computerized image analysis have been approaching it from a way that I am not approaching it. They've been computer scientists and electrical engineers, disciplines that are not necessarily known for high visual skills. I've been taking the work of one of the world's great artists and incorporating what he's taught me along with mathematics and approaching that problem of computerized image analysis from a very different direction. Now, whether or not it'll be successful remains to be seen. I'm going to talk about some of that tonight as well, of where this is leading. But it's approaching it, thanks to this interdisciplinary collaboration, in a fundamentally new way.
Charles Falco is Chair of Condensed Matter Physics and Professor of Optical Sciences at the University of Arizona. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much for your interest in